Well, I don't have a microphone or anything here, so I'll have to rely on my old boisterous self. I'm the director and founder of the Wilderness Education and Research Center. We're an organization that seeks to reserve, preserve, and disseminate information concerning ancient lifeways, woods lore, and wilderness survival. Just to clarify a little further who I am and what I'm doing here, maybe a little further anyway, I'm a practiced mountaineer and a member of a search and rescue team, for which I'm a tracking and wilderness survival specialist. I studied ancient life ways, and that's the crux of my knowledge about wilderness survival, is ancient life ways. For the better part of my life, I've been involved with the Native American community for quite a few years, not only in the sense of supporting various Native American issues, but also I've been on a number of reservations where I was lucky enough to spend some time with various spiritual leaders. I've been in a sweat lodge under traditional leadership by now hundreds of times. I've been involved in the so-called vision quest. And most recently, I became a sun dancer. And I'm hoping that most of you know what that is. I don't have a whole lot of time to explain it. So sun dance involves a process where you dance for 4 days without food or water. It's a very, very tough thing to go through. It inevitably makes the individual who goes through it a so-called pipe holder. I was kind of told when I was involved with the Sundance, I basically had no choice, that I was leaving with a pipe, and that requires certain real special responsibilities to be carrying that pipe. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about my experiences with the Native American community. I'm going to talk a little bit about ancient life ways and skills and related philosophies, especially where they concern, you know, wilderness ceremonial communion. I think that some of what I have to say is important, you know, at this point in history, about the advancement and evolution of humankind. It's a message, you know, that I think I'm delivering from the Native American community to the non-Indian community. Anyway, I'm going to start out by talking a little bit about a sort of enigma, if you will, that's been unfolding in my life for quite a few years. In my teens, I had some extremely emotional experiences that were very difficult to make it through. And they were followed up not too long after by, for lack of better terms and short explanation, they were followed up by a couple of specific paranormal experiences that served to kind of shatter my religious and conventional beliefs. And these things really motivated me to try to find out what's at the core of human existence, to try to find a way, something to believe in, something I could really believe in. So I sort of dove into a self-guided study of philosophy, parapsychology, nature and historic studies, and other related interests. And that kind of consequently led me to Native American beliefs. And I was instantly amazed by what I now call the Native American phenomenon. Because I realized that the Native Americans had expressed an unparalleled example of human potential. That they had been a great example of expanded sensory and physical abilities, unparalleled in human history and unknown to us now. I recognized that they had a profound understanding with nature that was supported by a complex series of what might be called spiritual sciences that now begin to parallel the greatest minds in the modern scientific world. But foremost, for me, I saw that the Native Americans had in a major, extremely important way unraveled the most perplexing fundamental question in human history, the who, what, where, when, how, and why of human existence. So I saw that the people in general were a phenomenal expression of human potential, and then I saw the extreme examples. You know, I saw and examined the lives of people like Crazy Horse and Geronimo, Chief Joseph, Kawana Parker, just to name some more well-known names. The list goes on and on and on. Geronimo expressed unbelievable human potential. Examining Geronimo's life for some people can be controversial because there was a lot of violence attached to what happened there. But setting aside that fact, Geronimo pulled off some things that to us now seem, and to people back then, seem magical. If I tell you that Geronimo led small war parties of 8 or 12 people, sometimes women were included in these parties, and that they ran from 100 to 200 miles into Mexico in 24 hours or so, you would think I was crazy, but they did. He expressed tactical and strategic superiority over both the Mexican and American military. Led small parties, like I say, of 8, 12, 15 people up against 300 soldiers and lived to tell about it. Anyone who could run, you know, 200 miles a day across the godforsaken deserts in Arizona, New Mexico, northern Mexico has my vote. Crazy Horse, you know, I don't want to go too far into talking about who these people were and what they did, but again, you know, an individual that expressed unbelievable human potential. Real quick here, you know, when he was young, he had a vision. I'm not going into great detail here. Basically, the vision told him that he, you know, was sort of assigned to lead his people through a very difficult struggle. And that if he did the right things, these specific things his vision told him he had to do, he would never be wounded in battle. And he never was. And when you really look at that, when you look at the big picture there, you realize that it's almost impossible he wouldn't be wounded in battle. Because Crazy Horse led his people into battle, always first and foremost, always at the front of the line. He always broke the enemy's line before his warriors followed him. He went right into the midst of bullets and arrows flying everywhere and didn't come out with a scratch. So much other phenomenon is connected to these extreme examples of human potential. But these were attributes that I saw in the Native American people, whether it be the extreme or general examples, that were obvious to me that were not present, you know, in my society, in modern society. And if they were, they were heavily damaged and degraded. But I saw in an early age that we had created a highly technological society, but that we'd lost the fundamental answer to who, what, where, when, how, and why of human existence. I saw that our society, for the most part, was egocentric, motivated by monetary and material things. I saw that my people were pursuing, you know, material success and the fulfillment of wishes, dreams, and desires. And to me, you know, that made life seem kind of empty. I mean, how could I go through a whole life? And I mean, that's all I get. I don't get to understand who I am, why I'm here, why I was born, why I have to die. In this modern society, I also recognize that religion and science was answering the fundamental question for the modern people. No one had to think for themselves anymore. I saw the Native Americans that they had answered the fundamental question largely because they thought for themselves. Because they didn't want anyone to think for them. Because they didn't want anyone to tell them how it is. Because they were brave enough to stand up to the mystery. At this point in my life, I was faced with two major important dilemmas. One is that I saw that my society had lost the fundamental answer. And also that they had purposefully engaged in the destruction, annihilation, and suppression of the fundamental answer, the shamanic society and the Native American people. They felt responsible. I often wondered what motivated this enemy. What motivated this to happen? What motivated the modern people to have engaged in this kind of destruction, this kind of an act? I didn't really think it was the people, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't really know who this thing was, this thing that I decided was my enemy, my people's enemy. I didn't know who this enemy was. I didn't know what it was. The second part of my dilemma was that if the Native American people had the answer, you know, to the fundamental question, was it too late? Could it be retrieved? So I began to examine ancient life ways at this point in my life and wilderness survival skills. What the people, what the Native American people, other ancient people knew about the fundamental answers would be locked in the ancient skills, in the wilderness skills. It became apparent to me that answer was safely protected and secured somehow within those skills. And I later found out that in fact it was through those skills that Native American people taught their children about the fundamental answer of who, what, where, when, and how and why of human existence. I also kind of got really interested in history, and found out that it's actually an extremely powerful subject that allows awareness and clarity to see where we've been so we know where we're going. But I also wanted to take a good look at what was recorded Native American history, see if I could find some answers to my dilemmas, to my personal questions. I wanted to look at non-Indian history to see what the hell happened, to see where this enemy came from, see if maybe I could catch a glimpse of this enemy. Maybe if I retrace the modern world's footsteps, maybe I could uncover some information about the fundamental answer. So I worked real hard. I plowed my way through the books at my young age. I did everything that I could possibly do. I joined every organization and club. whatever that I could. I looked for information everywhere that I possibly could, but something was missing for me. Now eventually, through partially luck and perseverance, was able to go to the Native American people and ask what they knew, what they thought happened. And I found myself in the homes of medicine men, spiritual leaders, and traditional people. And though not all of my Native American friends knew each other, it seemed like they were all trying to teach me one really important related thing. It seemed almost like one knew what the other was doing. Basically, I realized now that what they were teaching me was warrior philosophy. And in my years, you know, of learning about warrior philosophy and talking about warrior philosophy, it seems like 9 times out of 10, I run into somebody who says, well, I don't like that word, warrior. And I understand, you know, people's need to support peaceful things, peaceful resistance, and all those other concepts. We have to understand that this word warrior came from the Native American people. They had their own word. Well, we turn around and translate it, the word is warrior, includes the word war. We automatically assume that that has a violent connection. But what I found out about being a warrior is that a warrior's true primary objective is a spiritual one. That protecting the people and going into battle is secondary to the primary objective of being a warrior, the spiritual objective. So a warrior's not necessarily a soldier. Really, the true job, I found out, of a warrior is to learn to unravel the mystery, the great mystery of life, that fundamental question. In a way, a warrior is the Native American parallel to a white man's priest. Only I think now that it's more complex and involves, you know, more than religion. I was taught that a warrior's primary tools are mind, spirit, and body, like a triangle with three points. It's one thing. I was taught that that was very important for a warrior to understand, that mind, spirit, and body are one thing. I was taught the concepts of all my relations. When I would be around my Lakota friends, I would hear them say, Omatakweasin, all my relations. For a couple of years, I didn't understand what that meant. Yeah, I can understand the idea that I'm related. All my relations, I'm related to lots of things in the universe. I realized then that the idea is deeper than that. I realized that the concept that these people were trying to teach me, this ancient concept, was one that tries to tell the warrior, that tries to tell a person that you're related directly to everything in the universe, that everything is one, that I am the bear, that I am the eagle. And that if I learn to emulate these things, that I can actually learn and communicate with the bear and the eagle. I was taught that we're creating reality, that we're responsible for all the good and all the bad that's happening around us. I was taught that ancestral heritage is extremely important. And that I am my ancestors back to the beginning of time. I was taught that everything around me, that all the things of the universe, of the earth, are sacred and alive. And when I would go into the sweat lodge, I'd hear people talk of the rocks and call them the oldest people. I didn't understand that concept at first. The oldest people, the rocks. And this man would say, no, they're alive. Maybe not like you and me, but they're alive. I was taught that the mountains are alive, that the earth is literally our mother, that it's alive, that fire is alive, that water is alive, that the wind is alive, that can be communicated with. But I was told that I'd have to be willing to sacrifice. I'd have to be willing to accept the struggles in my life instead of crying about them, instead of complaining. That I'd have to be willing to fight. I was told that that would make me strong, wise, and healthy. An analogy, the medicine man, or a spiritual leader friend of mine once told me, is that, you know, when you see the elk bed down at night in the forest, he always seeks a spot where he'll be surrounded by forest litter, because he has to worry about the predator coming in. And he has to sleep with one eye open. He doesn't know anything about deep sleep. He'll never get to enjoy rest and sleep like humans have, like we have. That's never going to happen in his life. And that seems sad, in a way. But what it does for the animal is expand its sensory and physical capabilities. Teaches it grace. Gives it power. So I was taught that indulgence in life, you know, it was a waste of time and energy. There were things called acts of a warrior. That one tries to avoid indulgence for the most part. This doesn't mean that a warrior doesn't have a good time, it doesn't stop to smell the roses, but it does mean that the warrior will be moving on. I was taught that the sweat lodge, the vision quest, the sun dance, and so many other things were warrior's rites. They were acts of power that were designed to help the warrior balance and focus, to direct the warrior, to keep the warrior fixed on the true target. I was taught that ignorance and self-importance is the name of the enemy. I was taught that the evildoers, you know, people in our world that aren't evildoers, are victims of the enemy. They're not the enemy. And that's a mistake I think that's the way people make in our world. We look at the evildoers and we say, hey, that person's got to be stopped. We got to stop. That person's our enemy. And that person's not our enemy. They're victims of the enemy. So, I was taught that true fulfillment is found in the expression of human potential. Of expanding one's human potential. A true fulfillment is found by seeking the answer to the fundamental question. I was taught that expanding human potential builds strength, bravery, conditioning of mind, spirit, and body. Expressing human potential prepares the warrior to seek the fundamental answer. Now, a spiritual leader that I knew put it this way. He said that we at this time in history are in a unique kind of a situation here. He said that various historical events, not only in the Native American world, but in the non-Indian world too, had caused people to doubt the spirit. Where people had religions and believed in a God before, they were doubting it. Where people believed that there was spirit out there, they were doubting it. He said, he put it this way, kind of, he said, over here on the right is the idea that we're nothing more than biological beings. We're born into this world, we live an apparently meaningless life, and we die from this world, and it's a done deal. Pretty depressing place to be. But he said over here on the left is the idea that something very mysterious, very powerful, very phenomenal is happening, that the spirit does exist, and that it's out here, far off to the left. He said that in all human life, people fluctuate from being over here on the right in this depressing place to making it down the road a little ways. And they fluctuate back and forth. At some time in their life, they end up back over here again. But then maybe they fight their way back down the road a little ways. And they fluctuate a little bit. But then most of them never make it very far down to the left. He said that some people get out of this very depressing place and make it down the road a little place and set up camp and stay there the rest of their lives. And never go on down the road to really see and know what's out there off to the extreme left. We said that for a warrior learns to work his way down that path off to the left with skill and technique and training, with information and leadership and guidance from the medicine men and the elders. So the warrior works his way out down to the left, as disciplined as possible, as well trained as possible. He looks and observes for the tools, anything that a warrior can use or improvise even, to make it down this road to the left, to see what the hell's out here. As a warrior makes his way down this road to the left, he attempts to collect evidence that he'll hopefully, forgive me for saying he, or she, because I believe women can be warriors too. I got sounded about this a few days ago, in fact, so I'm clearing it up. The warrior's job is to collect evidence and bring back proof. A warrior's not asked to accept anything in blind faith. A warrior's not asked to accept Makoto ways. A warrior's not asked to accept Gabalino ways. A warrior's not asked to accept Cheyenne ways. A warrior is told, you need to find out for yourself. So, a warrior's job is to fight his way down to the left, down the road, to try to confirm the existence of the sacred for power. If a warrior is able to gain some kind of energy, some kind of power, and is able to heal himself or someone else, that's evidence. If a warrior is able to bring back insights, whether they be psychic insights or some kind of information he would not have otherwise known, then that's evidence. If a warrior learns to create and produce out-of-body experience, then a warrior is able to prove to himself that there is something underlying the core of human existence, that there is more than what meets the eye going on. If a warrior learns to master his dreams and become awake in his dreams, in his or her dreams, if a warrior is able to realize that there really is something to communicate with in dreams, that maybe it really is another level of reality, then the warrior brings back evidence. I was given a warning, though. Since most of us are dying to believe, we're dying to believe in UFOs, we're dying to believe in ghosts, we're dying to believe in the spirit, we're dying to believe in God, we're dying to believe in the phenomenal. Most of us will accept anything and not be critical of it, not really look into it to see if it's real. Most of us will be sheep and follow instead of be warriors and ask if what I have is real power or just the image of it. Another analogy, I was taught that the weaponry of a warrior now who's trying to fight his way down to the left, the tool that a warrior uses to protect his or herself working their way down this road is the spirit arrow. And the spirit arrow is knowing. The more that a warrior can know who, what, where, when, how, why, the more finely honed that arrow will be. The bow that fires that arrow is wisdom. So, there's also taught that for every warrior that's born, 1,000 will follow. I was taught that if I could somehow fight my way down the left of the road and become a warrior, that maybe in my lifetime 1,000 warriors would follow me. Maybe. I was taught that the only true profession in life is to seek to know, that everything else is secondary to the fact. That to have a career and nice family and cars, that's nice and everything, but that's not the true fulfillment of life. The only thing that lasts forever is knowing. Now, the same spiritual leader friend of mine once asked me why I think that I was drawn to enter the wilderness. In fact, he asked me why I was such a fanatical mountaineer and why I spent every last penny that I had on gear. I said, well, I don't know. Fun? He said, well, you go on these long, painful hikes out into the wilderness. You face a myriad of dangers. Wind and changing weather conditions. You go up against the elements, the threat of avalanche, the menacing threat of the grizzly. You spend days and weeks out there in cold, uncomfortable environments and eat garbage. That's fun. I said, well, maybe you're right, it's not fun. So maybe, I told him, I don't know why I go. He told me that because a part of me knows, part of my totality, deeper part of myself knows that something's out there in the dark. And that the goal is to practice. He summed it up this way. He said that what it takes to go is what it takes to know. He said that this fundamental answer that I'm looking for is out there in the dark, surrounded and shrouded by mystery and uncertainty and danger. But that's our condition. That's where we are as human beings. They could look out to say that's Wocechulo. That's the way it is. So, I was taught that skill, strategy, and technique is necessary to fight your way down to the left, down this road. I was taught that the answers I'm looking for are in my subconscious, but I was taught that the mountains are the subconscious. That's why I'm being drawn there. I'm being drawn to my subconscious. That my subconscious, you know, the mountains, the subconscious of Mother Earth, are one and the same. But the answer's in my subconscious, and the answer's in the subconscious of Mother Earth. And that's why I was drawn to go. Now I look back at some of the mountaineering trips I've been on, and I realize I wasn't there for fun. He gave me another warning. He said that it's extremely important to include in these things that I was doing to find this answer. It was extremely important to include the ceremonial act. But his idea was that he was looking around in our modern world and people had forgotten the power of the ceremonial act. The act of acknowledgement with the universe, the act of thanksgiving with the universe, the act of union with the universe. He told me that ancient ceremonies were designed to help a warrior focus power, to balance a warrior, to prepare a warrior for his struggle, make it down this road and find the answer. He said it was extremely important also to include the values of a warrior: honesty, honor, bravery, dedication, discipline, strength, all designed to temper and direct the warrior. So now, I personally have gained a deep understanding of why I'm here. The Lakota have another word, hokahe. That means it's a good day to die. For some, it's hard to understand that concept, hokahe. But I understand it. It's a good day to fight for what I believe in. It's a good day to be brave. We're on the verge of the greatest battle in human history. I'm really not afraid to give my life standing up for what I believe in, for my children and my grandchildren. I believe that overcoming the enemy of ignorance and self-importance is to find, once again, for our people, the fundamental answer. Is to once again bring humankind back to a utopian lifestyle, not unlike the lifestyle that the Native American people lived and preserved for so many thousands of years. I believe that not to overcome the enemy, ignorance and self-importance, is to see the end of life as we know it. The enemy seems really elusive. But history shows us that the enemy is deadly, deceitful, and very formidable. The enemy is malicious, ruthless. The enemy is us. And we're the victims of ourselves. If we learn one of the most primary aspects of being a warrior, to take full responsibility for everything that happens to you, and I don't care what it is, everything. If you come down with cancer, take responsibility for it. If someone tries to mug you, take responsibility for it. If you're living a miserable, psychotic life, take responsibility for it. I know now that one of the most important aspects of being a warrior is that you stop blaming everything around you. You stop blaming God and the devil. No one has to carry my mistakes. I'll carry it myself. That's the primary idea in warrior philosophy. So, in the end, I realize, you know, like I said earlier, we are the creator. I think it's really important for the new warriors. I see a lot of people in the so-called archaic shamanic revival calling themselves warriors. And most of us realize that this battle isn't necessarily, at least not at the forefront, being fought in terms of combat and violence. It's important to see to it that that doesn't happen. It didn't work for the warriors in the Indian Wars. History's shown us that. What we're fighting is a war against ourselves. A war against self-importance and ignorance, like I said. It's important for all of us to wake up, be responsible for everything that's happening to us, be tactical and strategic, and learn to stalk yourself. To learn to stalk humankind. We could just pick up in our society, you know, little understandings like that. I think we could defeat this enemy. and regain what belongs to us, our ancient heritage, the right to know who the hell we are and what's going on here. So, I'm about to wrap it up here. But I just want to deliver a little message, you know, kind of for those of us in the room here, to the psychedelic community, to the so-called archaic revival community. It's extremely important at this point to treat the old ways, to treat the Native American people's knowledge with respect. You know, to listen to the ancient voice, to listen to the elders. We in the so-called archaic and shamanic revival are being watched by the Native American people. Native American people have been ripped off enough. So many people have gone to Native American people and gotten information and other things and used it for personal advantage. And once again, have ripped them off. We all need to see to it that that doesn't happen anymore. We need to make friends with the Native American people because we need their help just as much as they need our help at this point in history. But if we act foolish and disrespectful and dishonorable to Native American people, there isn't going to be any help. I feel like I've been lucky to have spent time with some, you know, really well-known and powerful spiritual leaders, some medicine men and other wonderfully powerful and whimsical elders. We have to make sure that we don't rub these people the wrong way. We don't hurt them anymore. Like I said, you know, their assistance and help at this point for someone trying to fight their way down the road to the left is extremely, extremely important. So, you know, my message is, when we plot our way through this thing called the archaic revival, I hope it happens. But it's important for us to not abuse the way, to treat it sacred, to support the Native American community, but to be extremely patient when we do, and to understand that it was our forefathers that damaged their community, so that when we show up in their community now and say, oh yeah, hey, I'm looking for some spiritual help and guidance here, to realize that their community, you know, needs some help and some repair, that they've sustained extreme damage, but there's a lot of confusion in their own community, a lot of pain, disappointment and sorrow in their own community. So you're not responsible for the destruction of the Native American people's utopian world, but you're responsible for cleaning it up. That's what your forefathers passed on to you, and that's Wotetsulo. That's the way it is, whether you like it or not. It's our job to clean it up and to protect and to preserve what's left. And now, real quick before I close here, you know, I had gone to see Terrence McKenna at the Rim Institute. Spent a couple days up there. A friend here in the room was with me, in fact. And I remember something stuck into my head. So when I got dropped off, one of the guys said to me, yeah, he was telling me about...
Okay, well, we have Cliff Benton now, and bad news about him.
Well, Cliff is a longtime friend of my partner, Tim Perkins, and I. He worked on the Earth Festival with us. In fact, he was majorly responsible for getting the Gabrielino Indians out of the area where I grew up, the San Gabriel Mission, recognized by the state of California. Up until then, they had considered them extinct, and they recognized Vera Rocha as the first woman chief of the Gabrielino Indians, and Vera and Manuel worked a lot with Cliff and Tim. They were responsible for bringing Vera and Manuel back to Hohamunga, which is the Arroyo Seco and Devil's Gate Dam area, and it is now the ceremonial name of the area has been returned to Hohamunga. and this is a wetlands area up in Pasadena, and they're reclaiming it now. And Vera and Manuel basically got involved because of Cliff Benton. Cliff was just recently at the meeting of our Gathering of the Minds out at Chapman College. He was the host of the Gathering of the it's been a wild day, Way of the Ancient Warrior seminar, sort of a men's panel that was going on at the same time I hosted the women's panel. And he was a featured writer in Psychedelic Illuminations for the Native American section. He also did some interviews for your show, Roy, with us, with Rolling Thunder and Corbin Harney of the Western Shoshone Indians. And he was basically Tim's and my children's medicine man, because we don't take pharmaceutical drugs, so this kind of fits in on a Tuesday night also. Whenever we got sick, we'd call Cliff, and he'd bring us our medicine. He was a sun dancer. He was a pipe holder. And today, someone shot him and killed him. He was coming home from San Bernardino up to his home in Lake Arrowhead, and he stopped at the Waterman Canyon. He loved to stop and do a little nature walk on the way home. And a gentleman walked up to him and said something to him in Spanish and shot him. Just Cliff didn't even understand what he said, and Cliff was still alive at that point. He got away and went down by the creek and sort of circled around, so he came up behind the gentleman and got up to the road, and strangely enough, someone that he and his wife knew came by and picked him up and got him down to the hospital, but he was so tore up inside and he bled to death. And we're here tonight because what he had to say, he showed up at the hemp rally the first time he made it down for the hemp rally on Saturday, got to meet Stephen Gaskin and some other wonderful people, and we decided to put him up on stage because he does have a very important message, and he's a very wise person. You know, I'd just like to read what the biography that they did for him for the Gathering of the Minds, because it really sort of gives you the feeling of what Cliff was about. He was a director of Outdoor Enterprises. He's the director and founder of Outdoor Enterprises Wilderness Education and Research Center, and an expert of ancient life ways, woods lore, and wilderness survival. He was a student of Native American ceremony and ritual and a Native American activist. And I also want to add that he loved children. He spent a lot of time with my daughters and his daughter, taking them into the woods and telling them stories and teaching them about nature. He even taught me how to walk in the dark without a flashlight in the woods. And it can be done. You don't need the batteries. So I would like to present Cliff's talk that he did at the hemp rally. It's something I think that will follow him forever.
This is from last Saturday.
Right.
Cliff's last talk.